Ladies and gentlemen, during our conversation last night at the reception and during the dinner and even today, some of you were wondering out loud, who was the person that discovered the comet 114P? And I said, well, she happens to be our speaker today. And so at some point, Jennifer, I'd love for you to tell us the story of how you discovered a comet now named after you and your colleague. You have the bio, Dr. Jennifer Wiseman. I want to emphasize, and I'll let her emphasize also, that she's here speaking in her capacity as the Council President of the American Scientific Affiliation and the new Director of Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion for the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and not here speaking on behalf of the Hubble Space Telescope at the Goddard Space Flight Center. Is that the way I was supposed to say it? Well, I'll let you add.
I am an astronomer with NASA. I work with the Hubble Space Telescope program. But I'm here not in that capacity, but for another hat that I wear, which Michael just mentioned, which is with the American Association for the Advancement of Science, because I believe that my hat with that organization is more relevant to this particular group in that I direct a program there called the Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion, or DOSER program. So we'll get into some of that. But I'm an astronomer, so I can't resist showing you some things from space. So I'm going to
do
some of that.
Do you want us to dim the lights?
Well. Yeah, we can dim the lights.
We could. Here we go, Paul. If we could dim the lights, we can then see.
Okay, it would help me.
And we'll bring them up when you're ready.
Yeah, sure. It would help me if I knew how much time. Do I still get my hour? That's my question.
Almost that, but okay. We were going to break later in the afternoon for everyone to have 3 hour free time, but if you could do it in 45 minutes, so we'd be delighted.
Well, I can't remember. Was there time built in after my top four discussion as well?
Always is, and there
okay.
is.
So
we do want to have discussion.
I'm going to talk probably for an hour, and we'll go from there. So, okay, I found this morning's conversation incredibly helpful, insightful, very interesting. This afternoon, we are going to kind of go in a different direction, talking about how science impacts society, especially a society that's filled with faith-based communities and people of religious faith, where our values are often shaped through lenses of religion and philosophy, and even how we look at nature. So I like to use slides because astronomy shows such beautiful visual images. And also, I use them kind of as notes for myself. So we're not really, you know, I don't really want you necessarily fixated on the slides, but if it's helpful to kind of give us a guiding light through the things I want to say. I think the title of my presentation pretty much summarizes what I want to say, that we have the same universe that we live in, but we're looking at it with different lenses. All of us do, depending on what we're thinking about or how we're considering nature around us. And so this brings, in our society, science, ethics, and religion together in dialogue. Sometimes that's constructive, sometimes it's not. And you all have a major important role to play about the health of that dialogue in our society. I'm amazed by this comment by a philosopher, Kant. I believe it's written on his tombstone, where he says, two things continue to fill his mind with ever-increasing wonder and awe the more often and more intensely he reflected upon them. And those two things that he singled out were the starry heavens above him and the moral law within him. And I think those are still the two realms of things that we as human beings continue to grapple with, is the majesty and the intrigue and the amazement that we see in the universe around us, not only on the large scale, but also on the small scale, as science is telling us more and more about our genetic makeup and about even subatomic realms of physics. And then, of course, on the large scale of cosmology, all of this makes us wonder about our origins and where we fit into the universe. And yet we also wonder, who are we? How do we fit in? How should we live? Why do we have a sense of justice? Why do we feel that there are things that we need forgiveness for? As we discussed this morning, why is there a sense that there are wrongs that need to be righted? Where does that sense come from? And in fact, it is that perception that everyone has some innate sense of justice that drew even C.S. Lewis, who was mentioned this morning, into his own faith in God. So these are the two kinds of things that I think still we are grappling with in society today. So being an astronomer as I am, I'm going to spend maybe the next 10 minutes or so just kind of giving you a little update on the universe, and then we'll return to that a little bit later as warranted. We study the heavens with lots of different kinds of tools. We use telescopes. Telescopes can be on the ground in deserts or mountaintops, or they can be in space, such as this one. This is an orbiting satellite known to all of us as the Hubble Space Telescope. It's about the size of a school bus. It is whizzing around the Earth every 90 minutes or so. And it's still sending back marvelous data and images to us, even after being in operation for 23 years. So what we're learning, and we are continually awed by, is that the universe we live in is beautiful, and the universe that we live in is active. It is not stagnant. The stars and planets and galaxies are not just sitting there. There's a lot going on out there. We've learned that by using different kinds of tools, we can see the universe with different eyes. So this region will be recognized by many of you as the Orion region of the sky. You can see Orion's belt and sword here. Yeah. And the bright star Rigel down here, and red giant star Betelgeuse up here. This is an unstable star that may explode in a supernova possibly any day now in the next 100,000 years or so. So kind of get your concerns in perspective. But this is a picture taken with a telescope, a good one, on the ground. But if you look at these kind of fuzzy regions, somebody mentioned a nebulous question this morning, and nebulosity is something that we like in astronomy. Anything that's fuzzy we call nebulous. So this little nebulous thing down here, can't see the detail with this kind of telescope, but if you zoom in with the Hubble Space Telescope, you see something like this. It's much, much expanded. You see beautiful colors. And to astronomers, that's not only a sign of beauty, it's also a sign of great activity. It means that new stars are still forming, because when a new star coalesces out of condensing gas, for the large stars, the light is powerful enough coming out of the star to actually ionize the surrounding gas, meaning these photons of light go out into the surrounding gas, separate the photons, the protons from the electrons in the surrounding atoms. And then when these atoms sort of recover from that shock and they come back together, they release colored light, such as we see here. So this is called the Orion Nebula, and it is a very active region of ongoing star formation. Not only this colored region, which shows the result of recently formed stars, but if you look at this region with radio telescopes and infrared telescopes, you can see behind this into the darker regions where protostars are forming and heating up surrounding gas, but they haven't yet turned on. Very active. These clouds of gas and stars within them and between them fill up our galaxy. This is a galaxy, not our own. It's beautiful, I think, and it looks what we think our galaxy looks like in terms of its spiral structure, but we can't get outside of our Milky Way to take a picture back of it. So we can only learn about our own galaxy from looking around from the inside. But here's a similar galaxy that I think is quite beautiful. And there's so many stars in the core here that it just kind of blends together in this bulge of light. So in a typical spiral like this, you would have hundreds of billions of stars embedded in here. Our sun, we think, is about two-thirds of the way out in our own Milky Way galaxy, and one of several hundred billion stars. We're also learning that there are planets around many of those stars, which I will discuss later. And then looking in the background of this picture, you can see other galaxies. And in fact, we now know that there are hundreds of billions of galaxies in our visible universe. So if you can do the multiplication of hundreds of billions of galaxies times hundreds of billions of stars in most galaxies, you see that there is an enormous number of stars in our universe. And galaxies can interact with one another. These are two different galaxies, actually three. There's one here that are starting to be pulled together by each other's gravitational pull, and that starts to distort the spiral structure of these galaxies. In this case, we thought it was quite pretty. So Hubble, we released this as an image to celebrate an anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope, with this galaxy looking like the rose flower, and this looking like the rose stem. Okay, so how are we learning such things? Well, it's through the advancement of technology and, of course, the curiosity to explore. I like to show this little chart, which shows you over the last 400 years of time, graphically, how our technology has allowed an improvement in the sensitivity of what we can see in the sky over what we could just see with our bare eyes. And so this scale here is logarithmic, so every little tick mark above the one below it is 10 times more sensitive than the one below it. So these are enormous increases as we go up the scale here, starting with Galileo's little telescope, where he looked at Jupiter and noticed that there were these little moving blips of light around Jupiter. Every night they were in a different position. He realized that these were moons orbiting Jupiter. That, of course, had huge ramifications for human understanding of where we are in the cosmos and how things work. And then as eyepieces grew and telescopes enlarged, we were able to see distant star clusters, even other galaxies, faint galaxies, as we were able to record things with photography. Eventually, we began the idea of electronically recording images from the sky. You could receive light for hours or days on end to see very faint things. And that's how we really came to understand the magnitude, the enormous size and depth of our universe. We went to space with the Hubble Space Telescope. That brought us two orders of magnitude more sensitivity just by getting above the blurring effects of our atmosphere. And then with servicing of Hubble, that SM4 stands for Servicing Mission 4, we went off the chart here, because every time astronauts have gone up to this telescope, they've put in new instruments and new things that have enhanced its capabilities. So we really are at the very peak of this particular observatory's capabilities, thanks to the advancement of technology. So here's an example of technology, I think, being used and advanced for the good of humanity. And we can all think of ways in which technology has served humanity and served the world, and also ways when technology has been used for things that have been harmful. And so, again, you need a values system to decide what technologies you're going to develop and how you're going to use them. So there's our telescope. There's our astronauts that went up a few years ago for the last time to service the telescope, because we don't have a space shuttle anymore. The astronauts did a marvelous job in 2009 of putting in new instruments, doing repairs. And so we get back to this image you saw on my beginning slide of a star cluster, which is really just a test image for the newest camera on Hubble. But through this image, you can see how amazing stars can be. The beauty here is something that is worth just kind of staring at and taking in. Each star here is at about the same distance, because these stars are in all one single cluster. And so they're not they're gravitationally sort of held near to one another. So the brighter stars here really are intrinsically brighter. They're not just closer, they're brighter. And you can see red stars and blue stars and white stars, all kinds of stars. And again, it helps to see things in context. So this is the Hubble image, which astronomers like because of the precision of the telescope, the fine resolution. You can differentiate star from star. It doesn't just all mesh together. And so you can do quantitative studies of the stellar properties. But it also helps to see where these things are in context, this globular cluster of stars. So this is an image of a much broader field of view taken with a telescope on the ground. And then from here, we can zoom in this Centaurus constellation, to this one cluster, this globular cluster. And then we will transition over from this image into that taken by the Hubble Space Telescope, which gets a much smaller field of view, but higher precision. Some people like to see that twice. Some people don't. You want to see it again? All right. Let's see that again. I don't like that violent constellation, but there we go. Okay. So globular clusters are distributed around sort of what we call the halo of our galaxy, and they tend to hold some of the oldest stars in our galaxy. Okay, so that's the context. We also have things happening on the other end of a star's life. I talked about stars being born. Along with stars being born, there are planets being born. This is an image of an artist's conception of a very real planetary system discovered with the Kepler Space Telescope, another observatory in space. And this system has six planets that are in tight orbits, right? If it were our own solar system, they would be within the orbit of Mercury. So they're zipping around very close to their parent star. We have to do an artist's conception because most of these planets we're discovering right now outside our solar system, we're finding them indirectly, either because they transit in front of their parent star during their orbit, as these do, and you can measure the total amount of starlight that dips every time a planet orbits in front, or they cause the star to wobble as both the star and planets tug on each other during the orbital period. So you can actually detect the star wobbling and measure what kind of mass must be tugging on it. Hundreds of planets have been confirmed this way. Thousands of candidates have been found for planetary systems outside our own. On the other end of a star's life, we have this marvelous ejection of material from stars. This is what's called the Butterfly Nebula, and we have material here being ejected from this very mature star at hundreds of kilometers every second. It's quite beautiful, actually. We call it the Butterfly Nebula for that reason. But it's also indicative of how stars eject what they've produced through their whole life. Stars are little factories that during their process of shining, they're actually fusing hydrogen into heavier elements. And then as they run out of inner fuel, they eject all of that into the interstellar medium. It can fill galaxies, and eventually you can get stars forming out of that gas with heavier nutrients. We'll talk about that later. And then finally, for this little astro intro, I want to show you what we're doing with galaxies as a whole, what we're learning. In fact, we find that it seems that most galaxies, if not all, have something very dense in their inner core. We call it a black hole. It's where so much mass has fallen into this gravitational well, if you call it, that it has coalesced into a very, very dense region we call a black hole. And as material falls into a black hole, it can do odd things. Here's an example. This is a galaxy down here in this core, and there's lots of galaxies in the background here. This is a Hubble Space Telescope image. But these weird-looking lobes were imaged with a radio telescope that can pick up this kind of emission. These are jets being shot out far beyond the confines of the galaxy from material that has fallen in toward the inner black hole and then has been caught up in magnetic fields, ejected out the galaxy, and is interacting with the intergalactic medium in quite a spectacular way. These jets are moving almost at the speed of light, so this is really energetic. We do believe now that our own galaxy has a black hole in the core of it. We can tell because of the motions of stars in the core of our galaxy, but we don't see any evidence of this kind of hyperactivity going on from our own galaxy right now. We do, however, see evidence that galaxies like our own have gone through mergers. So here's an example of two galaxies that are being drawn together. Again, they will be disrupted as they get closer and closer. There won't be a lot of collisions between stars, but the disruption from tidal forces will end up like this pair, causing so much turbulence that you lose the original structure, and the turbulence spawns a whole bunch of new active star formations. So all these little bright nebulae are spots where new stars are vibrantly and vigorously forming. Our own galaxy is on a head-on collision course with Andromeda, our neighbor, sister, big spiral galaxy. And we just found that out for real, for sure, by modeling done based on Hubble Space Telescope observations and other observations a few months ago. So, again, our night sky might look quite different a few billion years from now, but you don't need to be too concerned because individual stars don't seem to be disrupted, at least not in the models. Okay, so we're in a very active galaxy, a very, very active universe. The universe is enormous in both space and time. I show this again as a sample galaxy. It turns out that galaxies fill the universe. This is the ultra-deep field of the Hubble Space Telescope. Each one of these little blobs of light is not a star, but is a whole galaxy with hundreds of billions of stars. And then this is just a little pencil beam area of the sky, so just imagine this extrapolated over the whole sky. And you get a mental image of how enormous the universe is. Here's a spiral galaxy, somewhat like our own. There's also a third dimension here. So some of these galaxies are very far away, and some of them are closer to us. And so astronomers are very interested in these distances. That's the hardest thing in astronomy, is to find the distances to other galaxies or to anything in space. But there are ways of doing it. And, of course, distance means time in astronomy, because if things are far away, it takes a long time for the light to get to us. So you're seeing things as they actually were in the past when they emitted that light. So in this case, when you look at certain galaxies, you're seeing them as they were in the far distant past, especially the more reddened ones, because as the universe is expanding, which we discovered some decades back, that light gets sort of stretched as it travels through this stretching space to get to us. And so it becomes more red in its wavelength or its color. So many of the most distant galaxies appear the reddest to us. Here's an example blown up for you of this very reddened galaxy. Turns out this is one of the most distant things we've ever seen. It's shining to us from the first few hundred million years after the Big Bang burst beginning of the universe. That sounds like a long time, but we think the universe had an energetic beginning about 13.8 billion years ago. This is shining to us from within that first 0.8 of the 13.8 billion year history of the universe. So this is a very young infant galaxy, hasn't done a lot of these mergers yet, hasn't grown into that big spiral structure. We're seeing it as it was, and maybe as our own galaxy was a long time ago. And in fact, there's this strong correlation between the improvement in telescope sensitivity and how far back in time you can see, because here you see telescopes getting better and better over time. As they get better and better, they get more sensitive, so you can see more faint objects. Well, many of the faint objects are the ones that are farthest away, which means you're looking at them from far back in time. And so this sort of graphic shows you that as things get better and better, we can see farther out, which in terms of galaxies means seeing farther back in time. The time scale down here is going from the present over here to toward the beginning of our universe, which would be over here off the right side of the chart. And so we're starting to see this age when the first galaxies began to form and come together. And then it took a long time, billions of years, for these galaxies to merge, to grow, for stars to form vigorously within them, and to go through cycles where stars build up heavier and heavier elements within these galaxies, to the point where galaxies today, like our own, have stars that are enriched with heavier elements and even planetary systems around them. Things change over time, and we can see that in astronomy. It's one of the few sciences that can that has the advantage of being sort of like a time machine. We can look at a galaxy back here in time and compare it to a galaxy here in time and see how they're different. And that's a really exciting privilege with astronomy. We can see that things have changed and indeed evolved over time in our universe. And again, stars themselves play a very active role in creating the habitat that we need for life, the conditions. This is an old star that exploded about 1,000 years ago. It's the remnants or the debris of this star is called the Crab Nebula. But Chinese sky watchers recorded this star brightening back in about 1,000 years ago, and we've been watching the debris ever since. We can also analyze the debris and see that it's full of these heavier elements that we need for life, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. These are things that are produced in stars and in their explosions that get incorporated into subsequent generations of stars, enabling the formation of dust disks and even planetary systems around stars, not the first generation of stars, but several generations on. So our own sun is not a first generation star. It's taken several generations of stars to get those heavier elements that we needed for our sun and our solar system. So it appears that our universe, with seemingly perfect underlying physical laws that govern it, shows a progression over time toward the production of stars and heavier elements, planets, and eventually life. Now, is that a sign of purpose? I've just taken a leap out of the science and into the philosophy, into the interpretation. What do we do with this? All right. Here we start our conversation about how science, philosophy, religion, and even ethics start to converse with one another, using astronomy as an example. Freeman Dyson, the physicist, said it wouldn't surprise him if it should turn out that the origin and destiny of the energy in the universe cannot be completely understood in isolation from the phenomena of life and consciousness, and that the design of the inanimate universe may not be as detached from the potentialities of life and intelligence as scientists of the 20th century, when he was writing, have tended to suppose. So, is this progression of the universe toward life as we know it, at least on one planet, is that a sign that the universe was destined for this, or is it just an accident? This is an interpretation question. You can't measure that with science. So then, what about this perspective of faith? Can you prove or disprove God through science and nature? And at this point, it's kind of good to point out what should be the obvious, but I think it's not obvious to a lot of people as we re-ask these questions over and over again, that science is, as we know it today, the practice of science is limited to questions of how and when and why in terms of physical cause and effect of how nature works, basically. While religious faith is equipped better to address questions like why, with a capital W, is there a purpose, is there a God, and how should we live? These kinds of things science is not really equipped to address, and religious tenets and faiths and texts are really not well equipped usually to address questions of how the natural world physically operates. Now, of course, there's a lot of conversation now as to whether these realms are so separate or not. Can you explain religious thinking through scientific analysis and so forth? So the conversation continues. For many people in the scientific community and in religious communities, the common ground that different groups can take is regards ethics. How do we use science? How do we use technology? Whether or not you're a religious believer, many people do care about how we are using science and technology and how it impacts humanity and the other creatures on this planet. So that can be a common ground where people of any or no religious faith can come together regarding issues of science and technology. So how do we relate science and religion? That's a very big, difficult question. There are many books in many libraries. Many theologians, scientists, philosophers have been writing about this much more than I've ever read. I'm a scientist, not a theologian, and not a philosopher. But there are some basic models that you'll see out in the public sphere that are being assumed or adopted when talking about the interface of science and religion. This is not meant to be a comprehensive description, but rather just a helpful introduction here. One model is this contrast model, which basically would state that there's no conflict between science and religion since they're responding to different questions. Somewhat what I just kind of said. Science is answering questions about the physical mechanics of nature, and religion is asking more questions of meaning and value and purpose kind of thing. The Stephen Jay Gould sort of non-overlapping magisteria idea. So you'll see that discussed, as I just did. There's a contact model, which is a little more interactive. This is a more positive approach, which doesn't say that, you know, science and religion can just stay out of each other's hair. It basically says there's more to it. It can be a positive approach in which looks for dialogue and interaction, such as, for example, ways in which science can help shape religious understanding, such as understanding better what's meant by the cosmos and the size and scale of the universe and the intricacies of life kind of thing. And public service and religion, and how science can also shape public service by people being better informed as to what kinds of public service are most helpful using the science and technology knowledge we're gaining, and how religion can often motivate scientific pursuits. Many of the great scientists throughout history and even today were motivated to do their research based on their religious convictions and their sense of worship or of appreciation of the creation. And then, of course, there's the conflict model, which is also widely discussed, which basically says that science and religious belief are inherently incompatible. I read a lot of comments out in the blogosphere and so forth about how many people perceive that science is based on testable information, whereas religious belief is based only on basically groundless faith, that these are very two different approaches to understanding things and they're incompatible, or even worse, that religious belief has maybe been an impediment to scientific advancement. And so there are those voices out there as well. And so you'll see as you read and write, and I'm sure you've run across it, and maybe even in your own writing, you'll see assumptions from these different perspectives coming through. For example, here's some perspectives. Again, I go back to the lauded physicist Freeman Dyson, who said, you know, why are we here? Does the universe have a purpose? Whence comes our knowledge of good and evil? These mysteries and 100 others like them are beyond the reach of science. They lie on the other side of the border within the jurisdiction of religion. So he's sort of speaking, at least in this quote, from that contrast point of view. These realms or approaches are asking different kinds of questions, and so they are separate. Francis Collins, who wrote this best-selling book, The Language of God, geneticist, I believe he's more of the ilk of the contact model, that there's something positive to be gained by having more contact and dialogue between science and religion. He said, we cannot discover through science alone the answers to the questions, why is there life anyway, and why am I here? And then Richard Dawkins, who's well known for advocating more of a conflict model, here he says what I think many people also believe, where he says, I think that when you consider the beauty of the world and you wonder how it came to be what it is, you are naturally overwhelmed with a feeling of awe, a feeling of admiration, and you almost feel a desire to worship something. I feel this. I recognize that other scientists such as Carl Sagan feel this. Einstein felt it. We, all of us, share a kind of religious reverence for the beauties of the universe, for the complexity of life, for the sheer magnitude of the cosmos, the sheer magnitude of geological time. And it's tempting to translate that feeling of awe and worship into a desire to worship some particular thing, a person, an agent. You want to attribute it to a maker, to a creator. And here's the punchline for him. What science has now achieved is an emancipation from that impulse to attribute these things to a creator. So for him, science has basically emancipated us from earlier models that humans have made up, basically, to explain the inexplicable. Now, of course, others would not interpret it the same way. So I just wanted to give you some examples of different perspectives. And of course, these are all from kind of these Western perspectives of science and religion being very different ways of thinking of things. But that's not the case in many Eastern cultures and religion. Virchand Gandhi said, in our country, religion is not different from philosophy, and religion and philosophy don't differ from science. So, you know, this whole idea that there's a science is a totally separate sphere of gaining knowledge and truth, independent of anything else, is a rather recent invention in the West. Let me mention a little bit about why scientific societies actually care about what our culture thinks about the interaction of science and religion. The American Association for the Advancement of Science, the nation's largest, the world's largest scientific society, has this program, which I direct, called the Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion. Why would a scientific society do this? This program has been around for probably 17, 18 years now. I've only been on board with it for three. But the program is established not to try to solve these theological issues or philosophical issues of whether science and religion are compatible or complementary or irreconcilable or actually necessary for one another. Rather, it simply brings religious communities and scientists together to have dialogue on issues of common interest and concern. So this program, the Dozer program, facilitates communication and understanding between scientific and religious communities, building on the AAAS's longstanding commitment to relate scientific knowledge to the concerns of society at large. Here's the issue. Many, many people in society are religious believers, or their views on the world or on their values are shaped through lenses and heritage of religious faith, through values that are shaped by their religious faith. And if science is always discussed completely apart from that, it's not serving society, it's not interacting wholly with society, even if science itself does not address issues of religious faith directly. This society publishes Science, which is a well-known scientific journal. It represents millions of scientists worldwide. And here's the mission: to advance science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. Our little motto is advancing science, serving society. Here we have this idea that having a conversation about or a dialogue between science and religion is a way of serving society. This fits into the scientific society's goals of fostering communication among scientists and the public, producing responsible conduct and use of science, enhancing the workforce so people aren't wrongfully keeping themselves out of being in part in the scientific workforce due to a misunderstanding of what science is, or helping the public appreciate science and technology more, and strengthening support for science and the technology enterprise. And so here's the kind of things that the secular scientific society does for public engagement, which includes lots of things, science updates. Many of you might be familiar with Eureka Alert. If you aren't, you ought to be, because this is especially designed for journalists and reporters to know about hot discoveries in science. Family science days, public science days, and then here we are, Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion program, along with science literacy projects in working with museums and other outreach activities. Well, what are some of those perceptions? For some, the perception is that science itself is actually a kind of religion that conflicts with their own religious beliefs, and they resent that being imposed upon them. And so, as I mentioned, there's often challenges in public school systems regarding what's taught in the classroom. Here's a story from the Kansas City Star from just a few weeks ago, where an anti-evolution group filed a federal lawsuit to block Kansas from using these new multi-state science standards in its public schools, arguing that the guidelines promote atheism and violate students' and parents' religious freedom. So that is why many people feel a sense of concern and threat about science, is that the science is carrying along with it some baggage beyond just the scientific knowledge, that there's an implication of materialism or atheism or some other baggage that's being brought along with the science. The lawsuit argues that the new standards will cause Kansas public schools to provide a non-theistic religious worldview by allowing only materialistic or atheistic explanations to scientific questions, particularly about the origins of life and the universe. The suit further argues that the state would be indoctrinating impressionable students in violation of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So you see, this is a concern that many people have. What's coming along with the science? And then what about scientists? What are they concerned about? Well, here we have Richard Dawkins on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and Stewart asked him whether the end of human civilization was more likely to come through religious strife or scientific advancement. In other words, Stewart wasn't so convinced that scientific advancement necessarily meant a wonderful, positive progression for society. I think skipping to the bottom here, Dawkins ultimately said that he thought that religious fanatics with access to the most destructive products of science posed the biggest danger to human civilization. But then Stewart countered, arguing that science contained certain risks in and of itself in the form of extreme or incautious advancement. So kind of an interesting little exchange there, which carries more risk? Is it religion or science? And then there are questions of ethics that are coming before us often. These are just examples. For example, the ethics of vaccines. Of course, we've heard about the controversies of whether vaccines produce other health problems and whether that's really true or not. But then there's also conversations about whether we can afford to vaccinate children. And here's a lash out at that kind of thinking that was also printed in Science Magazine back in September, where he says, you know, let's not forget these pitiful images of children in these terrible containers they had, breathing machines they had to go through back when we had to suffer polio and all these horrible diseases that immunizations have delivered us from. And so, therefore, it is more than a little ironic when we're told that we can't afford a needed vaccine despite the fact that it will save lives. The ethics, how much can we afford? Can we afford vaccinating all kids everywhere? How do we do it? The ethics of using technology for increasing human capabilities. We have, of course, this, as I mentioned earlier, the ability now to restore movement and things in people that have lost it through technology. That's terrific. But what about technology that's designed to make humans superhuman? We've thought about artificial intelligence or even human enhancement through drug therapy and so forth, making people better than they would naturally be, or this whole transhumanism idea that humanity will supersede our being attached to a body at some point. What should we be doing about that? These are ethical questions. I think all of us need to beware of what is sometimes referred to, and I honestly don't know who coined the term, but nothing buttery. In other words, when science comes up with an explanation for something, it's tempting to interpret it as, you know, this is nothing but what the science says. So the question is the scientific explanation for a natural phenomenon, including things like our human behavior, is that the whole story? In other words, if we find out that there's a natural explanation for altruism, why we care for one another, does that mean that there really isn't such thing as selfless caring? Or if there's a natural explanation for why people are drawn to religious faith or religious belief, does that mean that that's all there is, that there's no such thing as an external spiritual reality or an external God? At some point, the science only tells you the first part, but doesn't say anything about the second part, and that's often misunderstood. I'm going to take a few more minutes here, if that's okay. I'm about 10 more minutes here, I hope. So such a question, you know, for example, altruism, and there's many, many articles on altruism, much research on it, so this is just an example quote, but we find even in animal species, examples of animals helping other animals when it's of no benefit to themselves. Birds helping other birds raise their young, you could almost see how that would help the group as a whole. Or monkeys giving alarm calls to warn other monkeys of the presence of predators, even though by doing so they're attracting attention to themselves and their own possibility of being attacked. So, you know, what are we to make of that? Is altruism real, or is it something that's basically still part of a selfish motive deep down inside for survival? Those conversations come up at this interface of science, religion, and ethics. And then Franz de Waal, who's a very highly respected primate behaviorist at Emory, again talks from this vein that human morality grows out of prior animal morality. He says, I don't believe animals are moral in the sense we humans are, with well-developed and reasoned sense of right and wrong. Rather, that human morality incorporates a set of psychological tendencies and capacities such as empathy, reciprocity, a desire for cooperation and harmony that are older than our species. Human morality was not formed from scratch, but grew out of our primate psychology. Primate psychology has ancient roots, and I agree that other animals show many of the same tendencies and have an intense sociality. So the question here is, if we see that other animals have some of these characteristics that we would have previously incorporated only to human morality and a human sense of empathy and cooperation, does that mean that there is no external ultimate, you know, right and wrong or God-directed values as religious communities would see it? Is it all nothing but, and interestingly so, but an evolutionary process that comes through the survival of species? That's the kind of interesting interface where the science itself can be correct, but the question is that the whole story? And that's where religious communities are particularly interested. I think for writers such as yourselves, it's really crucial to dig deeper in some of these stories when you're talking about this interface between science and religion, because values and worldviews shape many of the concerns and interests regarding science. For example, authority figures. Who are people actually listening to and trusting in terms of information about science? And do deeply religious people look to different authority figures for questions and answers regarding science than do non-religious people? That's something our survey is going to get at. But, you know, it baffles a lot of scientists that I interact with when, you know, we put forth a lot of data on something. And yet the audience doesn't always just say, you know, oh, I see, you know, that's why you say that the climate is getting warmer, because here's the data. But they're getting information from other authority figures, either a religious authority figure saying that, you know, God has different plans, or a different science authority that has been filtered through their religious communities. And scientists are just the same. We're all this way. We look to authority voices that we trust to help us interpret what we're hearing if we're not experts in the subject matter. But if society is divided on which authority figures we're looking to for matters of science, is that going to cause a problem as our society moves forward? And then there are concerns about motivations and agendas that people sometimes wonder about these other groups that they're not as familiar with. Do scientists sometimes wonder if religious communities are trying to incorporate religion into the science classroom or something like that? And are religious communities concerned that scientists are, as we saw before, are sometimes trying to bring secularization or materialism or even atheism into along with the science as a kind of baggage? So what are the perceptions of motivations on each side? And there's also a very interesting a sense that people don't realize that scientists themselves have a very broad range of personal, religious, and philosophical beliefs. In other words, this perception that scientists are all atheists is not true. Certainly the spread of beliefs that scientists hold is not exactly the same distribution as the general public. But many, many scientists identify as adherents to traditional religious faiths, or would identify themselves as spiritual but not religious, the ever-popular new category of belief. And I refer you to, again, sociologist Elaine Howard Eklund. She's written an excellent book based on surveying over 1,000 scientists in elite research universities about their personal religious views and interviewing hundreds of them in depth, and finding out very interesting spread of religious beliefs amongst scientists. Her book is called, she doesn't like the title, but it's called Science Versus Religion, What Scientists Really Think. But it's a helpful book. So these are the kinds of things I think writing about science and religion, it's helpful to dig deeper for these kinds of perception questions that motivate many people's concerns. And there are tough questions that are often beyond science as we think about life on planet Earth here. What will, for example, the long-term future of the universe hold? Are we significant given the vastness of the universe in space and time? And now we even talk about this possibility that there's a multiverse, that there may be other universes with different physical forces and so forth. Does that just compound our sense of insignificance? Or does our significance come from something else, from our ability to look around and to make these observations? Does that actually imply that we have great significance? That's a philosophical question. It's been thought about before. Carl Sagan said, who are we? We find that we live in an insignificant planet of a humdrum star, lost in a galaxy, tucked away in some forgotten corner of a universe. So that's one perception you can take by looking at science and especially the universe and seeing its vastness and our place in space and time. It's not the only possible response. The biblical psalmist wrote, O Lord, our sovereign, how majestic is your name in all the earth. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you've established, what are human beings that you're mindful of them and mortals that you care for them? So that sense of insignificance right there. And yet the psalmist goes on to say, and yet you've made us just a little lower than God and crowned us with glory and honor. You've given us dominion over the works of your hands. You've put all things under our feet. So basically, this, in the psalmist's view, our significance has come from God's endowment of that significance to us. There's more tough questions that arise. Why do the same natural processes that are operating in the universe and on the planet and even sustain healthy conditions for life also cause pain, death, and grief? Is it just the random coldness of nature, or is there something more theological to be addressed about this? I think of plate tectonics, the motion of the Earth's plates that creates earthquakes and causes so much suffering. The plate tectonics also seem to recycle our atmosphere and give us more livable conditions. So are plate tectonics good or bad? What about what creatures do to each other. Is this okay? Is it neutral? Is there really such a thing as evil? I mean, science can't really address that. I think about what's happening, for example, to other creatures. There are elephant populations in Africa that are being attacked with military-style assault weapons, gunned down in whole families just for their tusks. And then elephants who have very strong familial connections, their relatives will come mourn and grieve their dead, and then they get gunned down too as they come to grieve. Is this okay? You know, we know something about the social nature of elephants now. Are we not responsible to treat them with compassion? All right, I'm going to close up now. Almost. I just want to say, on a more positive note, that the universe always holds new discoveries and new surprises, and that human beings seem to recognize the beauty of nature. And for some reason, we're drawn to the beauty of nature, and we're drawn to explore it, sometimes with varying responses. But I think that's why people love science. It's telling us more and more about nature. Theologian Calvin said that astronomy is not only pleasant, but it's also useful to be known, and it cannot be denied that this art unfolds the admirable wisdom of God. That was his take on it. It doesn't have to be your take on it. Physicist Weinberg felt that the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. So, you know, your response to what you see is not dictated by the science alone. I'm going to skip through all of this, but if you ask me about it in the Q&A, I'm going to tell you about exoplanets. Do we have time for that or not? I'm going to skip over it.
All that Lewis stuff.
Yeah, well, you'll have to ask me about it because I think I've gone over time. We're learning a lot about extrasolar planets, and it interfaces a lot with religious thought about the significance of humans. So if somebody asks me about that, I will talk about it. We're discovering also things through our study of galaxies. This magnified galaxy here is just a normal galaxy. It just is behind this cluster of nearer galaxies, and the dark matter and all the mass in this cluster is so powerful that it bends the light from the background galaxy and magnifies it in this weird, distorted way, so that we can actually learn more detail about this weirdly distorted light from the background galaxy than we can from the foreground galaxy. We can learn more information about this very distant galaxy than we ever could if it were isolated, simply because of this magnifying effect of nature. That's pretty cool, and astronomers are using that now to study these very distant galaxies by using nature's own magnifying lenses in the foreground. We've also found out that the universe is not only expanding, but that expansion is accelerating. And Adam Riese here won a Nobel Prize along with two colleagues, Brian Schmidt and Saul Perlmutter, for taking the observations that showed that our universe, which after its birth began to decelerate in its expansion, has now transitioned to a point of accelerating in this expansion. We don't know what causes that. We call it dark energy. So it's another mystery, another thing to go forward in studying. The beauty of the universe inspires everyone. Here's a young lady from the Maryland School for the Blind who's looking at a nebula just like that one, except she's looking at it through her hands. She's a visually impaired student, and these images have been created by NASA with textile cues. So there are different feels for nebulae and for galaxies, for planets and stars. And so by feeling these images, you can very much appreciate the beauty, just as many of us do with our eyes. And in fact, when I spoke to this classroom of students, they were every bit as excited about space exploration as anybody who looks at space images with their eyes. So how do we think about science and religion here? Alfred North Whitehead said that when we consider what religion is for mankind and what science is, it's no exaggeration to say that the future course of history depends upon the decision of this generation as to the relations between them. And I like the perspective of Sir John Polkinghorne, who spent his life as a physicist and the president of Queen's College, eventually in Cambridge. And then he decided to become an Anglican priest, and he's written some very helpful books on the interface between theology and science. And he says that science and theology are both concerned with the search for truth. In consequence, they complement each other rather than contrast one another. Of course, the two disciplines focus on different dimensions of truth, but they do share a common conviction that there is truth to be sought. I think that's a very key point. The reason people get energized about conversations about science and religion is that both scientists and many devout religious believers, and by the way, those are not exclusive categories. Many scientists are themselves religious believers. But they all believe that there is something called truth, something to be sought, something to be grasped, something to be learned about, as opposed to just total inconsequential relativism. And so I think in that sense, it drives a commonality between, in some cases, science or scientists and religious believers. I saw that somewhat in my own educational background. I went to my own education was at major research universities, and the religious groups of students, the fellowship groups of students there, centered on religious faith, were full of science students. Science students made up the majority of the students participating in these religious groups. Why is that? Well, I think it is partly because of this sense of a conviction that there's truth to be sought in both of these facets of life. If you want more resource sources, I could have made a list that's 20 pages long, but I just wanted to point out a couple of my favorite books, the Collins book, The Language of God. I also like this anthology, The Book of the Cosmos, Imagining the Universe, from Heraclitus to Hawking. This is a literary professor, Dennis Danielson, a professor of English at the University of British Columbia, who's created a marvelous collection of essays and excerpts from scientists and philosophers and religious texts throughout human history about thinking about the cosmos. The Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion program of the AAAS, I heartily suggest that you look at our website. We also are Facebook active, and we are new on Twitter, but we're growing in that realm as well. And then there are different religious communities that have their own organizations and websites that regard the interaction of their religious faith and science. The American Scientific Affiliation is a network of scientists who are interested in the relationship of science and Christian faith. Very good resources on their site. The Institute for Science and Judaism and a new organization called Sinai and Synapses are very interested in the interface of science, Judaism, and religion in general. And these, I could go on and on. There are organizations regarding Islam and science and humanism and science and so forth. There's a lot out there if you do a little digging for resources. There's also beauty to be held, and this is an image of the Horsehead Nebula we took in infrared light with the Hubble Space Telescope recently. And so you can see this marvelous ethereal image of one of these interstellar clouds where silently and quietly but very aggressively new stars are bursting forth in a very beautiful way. And then looking back on our planet Earth from servicing Hubble, you can see that little wisp of the atmosphere that shines around the circumference of the Earth there as the sun sets behind it. And I like this image because it just kind of reminds us of our own planet, the fragility of the atmosphere, the fragility of life here, and how at least there's life on this planet. We should all, regardless of our faith convictions, be good caretakers of this place where we live. So with that, I will close for the moment unless someone asks me about exoplanets.
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer. Right. Thank you very much. Welcome. Why don't we leave the lights off, because in case somebody says, I want to see a picture of whatever, we'll talk here in the dark for a moment.